Hello, listeners, and thanks again for coming back to hang out with me and my friends. Before we dive into our conversation today, I want to tell you all about something that I think everyone should go and lend their support to, and it all begins with a cup of coffee. Let me ask you a question. How much do you spend on coffee? Whether it's at Starbucks or Coffee Run, or your Keurig at home, or even good old-fashioned Folgers like my parents used to drink, we spend a lot of our money, and subsequently our time, on coffee. If you're going to continue to do that, might I suggest that you hop on your computer or your mobile phone right now and visit the Happy Bean Project. The Happy Bean Project was started by my friend Shannon Louise, and I'm so proud of what she's done. Shannon is an active duty artillery marine that, along with her amazing group of friends and volunteers, visits homeless shelters, mental health facilities, and much more. Right there on the spot, they make coffee for these folks, and they encourage them over that cup to discuss their situations, their struggles, and they give them a safe place along with a friendly ear, something many of these wonderful people have never had before. This is something I can really get behind. Our show is all about conversation, and I know what a positive conversation over a cup of coffee can do for someone. Head to thehappybeanproject.com to check out their online coffee shop where you can purchase some of their coffee, merch including beanies, hats, coffee mugs, stickers, and more. And 100% of your purchases and donations go to funding their coffee events all over this great country. The website is www.thehappybeanproject.com. This is the real deal. Again, this is not a paid ad. Go check them out. Your donation makes all the difference to some pretty incredible people. Live. So, Aaron, thank you so much for coming to the show. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me on your show. I appreciate being invited.
Absolutely. It's funny. So the book is Final Flight, Final Fight. And it's, I had heard about this book almost by accident because I don't know if you remember this or not, but I reached out to you quite some time ago, I think now, regarding a possible connection between Amelia Earhart and the Wasp. And you gave me some insight there and actually sort of recommended some living Wasp that I could speak with. And of course, that led me to contact Jill Myers, who's a dear friend of mine, and that's how we were able to conduct maybe my favorite interview ever with Bea Hadu. So it kind of worked out.
I remember that. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. So I remember you were super kind. I know you're like right in the middle of right before your book launched, or maybe right as it was launching. So you're probably super slammed, but you're able to pick up the phone and talk with me. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate you coming on now. I want to ask you, just sort of for the folks who might not understand what we're going to be talking about or don't really have the whole picture, can you sort of tell us how this all started for you? Because I know it's been a long journey and we're sort of looking back on the completion of that journey now.
It is completion of one journey, but the start of another journey, as I like to say, as things happen that way. So my grandmother was a pilot during World War II with the Women Air Force Service Pilots, also called the WASP as a nickname. And they were the first women to fly military aircraft for the United States Armed Forces, the Army Air Forces. At the time, the Air Force was created in 1947. So later on, the WASP were kind of owned by the Air Force, but originally were under the purview of the United States Army. At the time, they were created in a civilian capacity because Congress could not figure out if women should really become part of the Army to be pilots. Granted, there were women that were being enrolled or enlisted or commissioned in other parts of the armed forces, in the Marine Corps, in the Navy, in different capacities. But because these were pilots, it became a bit of a, you know, conundrum in Congress. Should we, quote, let these women become formally part of the Army? So instead of dilly-dallying about this, the women who ran the program originally, Jackie Cochran and Nancy Love, decided, look, under the purview of General Hap Arnold, let's just start this program. We'll bring them in as civilians. And then eventually Congress will hopefully figure it out and make them formally part of the Army, but we need them right now. So they went down to Texas to start training with the understanding they would eventually become part of the Army. As it happened, the United States Congress voted down the bill to make them formally part of the Army in the summer of 1944, and the program was disbanded in December 1944, and the women did not receive any benefits or recognition as formally part of serving the United States Army. And that came much later in the 1970s when they went back to Congress to fight for retroactive veteran status, which was signed into law by President Carter in 1977, which was around the time when I was born. So when I was growing up, I always saw my grandmother as a veteran. She had a uniform. She used to go to events and to the White House. We live, 8 miles from the White House. So she was invited to a lot of events in DC, mostly because she was just nearby and to be a representative of the WASP. And there were a couple other WASP in the area that were often also invited to these things. So I always saw her as a veteran. So when she passed away in 2015, my family was very surprised to learn that a few weeks before she died, the United States Army had done a review of their procedures at Arlington National Cemetery and had determined that the WASP were not eligible to be interned at Arlington National Cemetery on their own merit. So they rejected our application, which led into this whole campaign that I ended up leading on behalf of my family to get a new law passed through Congress to force the United States Army to recognize the service of the United States, the women Air Force service pilots, for the purposes of being laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery, which required lobbying in Congress and leading a media campaign. And we had a petition on change.org and a whole campaign of different aspects going through Congress. Ultimately, that was signed into law, and my grandmother was able to be laid to rest at Arlington National Cemetery about a year and a half after she died. All of that led into me eventually writing the book, which you mentioned, Final Flight, Final Fight. And now I use that story to go around the country teaching people about the women Air Force service pilots and my grandmother's story, as well as how do you lobby Congress? What is it like to get a bill passed? What is it like to work with members of Congress and sit in the office of a senator or a member of the House of Representatives and tell them about your story and what you need them to do and actually get it done and have people supporting you and manage a media campaign? So I use all of that in the book to teach people about this. And as a long answer, but
no,
that's the shortest I can do it with all that information that I have to talk about.
That's a great answer. Who, just for the record, what was your grandmother's name?
My grandmother was named Elaine Danforth Harmon.
Okay. So I have so many questions because as you're talking about that, that must have just been a incredible uphill battle to go through what you went through. And I guess I want to, so let's kind of work our way backwards. But while you're going through it, what, did you ever feel overwhelmed in the process that you were having to take on your own? I know it wasn't just on your own. You had a lot of people helping you and kind of joining the cause once you kind of lit the fire for everybody. But what was that process like for you? And what was the toughest point?
Initially, I felt overwhelmed because I felt like there was this huge obstacle in front of us. I grew up in the DC area. So on the local news every day, they talk about Congress, they talk about how things don't get done. And this is what I grew up with. So when I realized that what we really needed to do was get a law passed through Congress, I really was, thinking, I don't know if this is going to happen. This seems insane. But, we have to try. So, I knew what to do for the most part, the basics of it. So fortunately, we had a lot of people that were able to help us and we got all the right pieces together. But yes, initially it was very overwhelming, just the entire initial thought of, okay, now I need to go to Congress to get a law passed just so I can bury my grandmother. Seems crazy.
Yeah.
Once it got started and everything kind of started snowballing on top of it, I was way too busy concentrating every day on the day-to-day things that were happening to really think about how overwhelming it was, which was kind of a good thing.
Yeah, I bet.
But I was very anxious every day because I felt like every day one thing might happen that would derail everything. Right. You know how the news cycle is. If one thing happens, it can detract from other stories. And I felt very pressured to keep attention on our story, both on the bills going through Congress and in the media, and making sure that stories were coming out regularly so people out in the public knew what was happening and would support us and keep contacting their members of Congress and just to keep it in people's minds. Because I don't know, that's my impression, is you kind of have to keep attention to these things as they move through Congress. So they know it's important and people want it to get done.
How did it feel you when President Obama signed HR 4336 for you? I mean, was that must have been a pretty incredible feeling on the flip side of that.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing. I was very excited and very grateful, but at the same time, it was a weirdly anticlimactic moment because I was sitting at work and I got a tweet from a news reporter who works in the White House press pool. And he was like, oh yeah, he's just signed this bill. And I was like, wait, that's our bill. And it, you know, it was like, it seemed very anticlimactic, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, all this work you've done and you're just sitting at work and then you get a tweet about it. So,
yeah,
but it was very exciting, you know.
You know, mentioning that it's anticlimactic, is it, you know, for the people who are listening, that because what you did is really no small feat. I mean, it's remarkable is really an understatement. I think what you did is very powerful. But I want to ask you about, because, you know, they always say, well, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And, you know, you hear that all the time. What do you take away from the journey itself? Because as you just mentioned, it was super anticlimactic. It just kind of happened and it was just kind of came and went, like, okay, the bill was passed, the job was done. But what do you think you would remember the most about the journey itself as far as getting to that moment and then kind of going beyond that moment?
Well, throughout this process, I met a lot of people, both that my grandmother had known that I had never met, or maybe I had met one or two times. And a lot of people that my grandmother was part of their world that I was not part of those people's world, who became part of my world. And now we are friends. So I am very grateful for that process, that they became part of my world now. And now we're friends. And a lot of them are aviation community people, like people that go to Oshkosh or Sun and Fun, or people who follow the Women Air Force Service pilots. There are a lot, you know, quite a few people in Texas and some in Florida who help the WASP every year and, you know, help support them and go to the museum and just are a kind of extended non-related family people, know, like non-biological family, I guess you call them, who support them and have, you know, travel with them and help them go to events and things like that. And they've been doing that for decades. And I was not really ever a big part of that because I was in school and my grandma didn't want me to, you know, spend all my time following her around. She wanted me to do my own thing. So I was not very involved in all that stuff. I went to some things with her, you know, and one of the other things I really took away from that was something that I ended up talking a lot of in the book about, is this idea that my grandmother had two families. She had our biological family and then she had her aviation family.
Yeah.
And I always saw her as my grandmother, you know, someone who yelled at me for leaving the lights on and you know, not eating my vegetables or whatever, like normal grandma things. And on the flip side, she had this totally other life that all these people who were not her family saw her as, this historic aviator who served during World War II and flew military planes. And, you know, they see her in a completely different light. And I didn't really see her that way. But through this process, having to go to Congress and work with all these aviation folks who were supporting us and contacting their members, you know, their membership, all these different organizations, I got to know a lot of these people. And so I got to see my grandmother in a completely different light. So I talk about that a lot in the book, of, you know, having people that you grow up, you see them one way, and then all these other people see them in a different way, and kind of bringing those two families together through this process and at the funeral.
Yeah, that must have been incredible. I saw some of the footage of the funeral and of the service as well. And it's when you watch that and you sort of listen to people talk about her, it's weird because you have this, you know, people do have like these separate aspects of their lives, right? So you have like your work aspect and you have your family aspect, and it's almost like two different variations of the same person. But all these people just kind of knew a different piece of your grandmother. And I think that's pretty remarkable. Like if you know her one way and then you're exposed, you know, to the other aspect of her life or a whole other side of her life you weren't really fully aware of, or you just knew about on the horizon but didn't have a lot of detail, it can be pretty jarring, I imagine, to know that she had all these connections and she was this amazing woman that did all these incredible things.
Yeah, I mean, it was great for me, and it was I don't even know what the word is. Jarring isn't the right word, because I knew what she did. It wasn't a secret. It wasn't, you know, I went to some events with her. One that I mentioned in the book that was very memorable is when they dedicated the World War II Memorial on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C. She was a VIP guest, and I went with her, and we sat in the section with the World War II veterans, and it was a very big deal, and I was very honored to sit with her and go to that event with her. And so that was just another ironic thing, that we were invited to all these things where she was honored as a World War II veteran, and then she wasn't allowed to be buried as a veteran. So that was the most jarring thing, was that the government was not recognizing her service in the same way that all these other people were. And there are many WASP family members who did not know that their grandma, their mom, whoever, great aunt, served with the Women Air Force Service Pilots until that person had died. I have a friend who had no idea. Her grandmother passed away. They were going through all her stuff, and they found all these pictures and kind of documents and things. And she was like, what is all this? And she finally figured out that her grandma had served with the WASP, and she had no idea. So there were quite a few of them that didn't talk about it. And my grandma wasn't one of those people. So I wasn't super surprised in the way that those people were. That would have been, I think, very overwhelming to deal with.
Yeah.
But, you know, my grandma was very proud of what she did, not because she thought she was special or something, but because she felt like the group had done something important in the context of women serving in the military and as pilots and things. And so I think they realized that later, after the 1970s, when they had to fight to be recognized for their service, they realized, we need to talk about this. We need to let people know what we have done, and not because we think we're so great, but because we need to build on this every year and make sure women constantly are having opportunities to build on what other women before them have done.
Right. I guess my question is, and just for the people who may not know, who are listening to this or will be listening to this, why the denial of the rights? What was the reasoning behind that for them to say, no, you ladies are not being recognized, and you're not going to have the right to be buried at Arlington? What was the official denial reason?
So this is a very specific legal/legislative detail that gets into the weeds a little bit, but the law that was passed in 1977, the bill that went through Congress, which there were several iterations of the bill over many sessions of Congress because they didn't want to do this. Eventually, Senator Barry Goldwater from Arizona, who had worked with some of the WASP during World War II, decided to support them. And he's like, no, they deserve to be recognized. This is ridiculous. So he incorporated the language of the various bills that had gone through Congress into the GI Reauthorization Act so that it would definitely get passed through Congress and signed into law.
Okay.
That law was written in a way that granted them benefits that were authorized by the Department of, well, at the time it was called the Veterans Administration, but now it is called the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Yes.
Okay, so if you fast forward to 2015, when my grandmother passed away, Arlington National Cemetery is run by the Department of the Army. All the other national military cemeteries, which I think at this point we have maybe 138 or 9 of them, are run by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So what the Army was saying was that my grandmother and the other women Air Force service pilots and these other groups that were granted the same status under the law in 1977 were only eligible to be buried at Veterans Affairs administered cemeteries and not the Department of the Army cemetery, which is Arlington. So basically they were saying she was a veteran in one part of the federal government and not another part of the federal government. When I was explaining this to my mom, I was saying, you know, technically they're not totally wrong, even though I don't agree with them. I mean, the wording can be interpreted that way. It's not, you know, what I would want to happen.
Right.
But it does say, you know, her DD-214, which is the document you receive when you separate from active service, there's a box that says other. It has a little asterisk, and it said, this is for all purposes is issued under public law 95-202, which is for benefits authorized under the Department of Veterans Affairs. And so that was what the Army was using to deny her eligibility at the cemetery. Now, my grandfather did not serve in the armed forces because he had a physical limitation that prevented him from being eligible. So my grandmother was going to be buried on her own merit. So there are other WASP who are buried in the cemetery that were buried as a spouse. And previously, for WASP spouses, they didn't receive a military funeral. So that was another argument that had happened earlier. So this is like a constant thing over the years, these little nitpicky things about the wording of these laws. And, you know, it really highlights how important it is to write legislation very specifically to what you want to achieve. And if you write it too narrowly, then it can be used to deny people rights later on. But a lot of times it's hard to think of all the different possibilities or scenarios that might come up. So
yeah,
I don't necessarily blame them. It's just, it can be very difficult to write things that cover every possible thing that might happen.
Wow.
So that's the legal legislative history of that. So what the law that we were working on with my grandmother in 2015, 2016, that Representative McSally wrote was to amend the previous law to make sure that the wording included Arlington National Cemetery.
That's incredible. That's an incredible story. And I urge everybody to go out and get the book because it's all in there and it's really fascinating and it needs to be told. The story needs to be told. I want to ask you about, you know, how the book came into play for you. Was that something that you had always wanted to do? Was it something that just kind of popped up after you finished, you know, the first part of it? Where did the book come into play in all of this?
So I'm an attorney, so I write all the time. That's part of my job. So I'm a writer, but I have never written a book before. During this process of leading this campaign in Congress and doing these media events and interviews and talking to people in Congress and meeting all these different aviation people every once in a while would say, this would make a really great book. This whole story is amazing. And I would say, oh yeah, it would make a great book. And I just kind of be like, you know, okay, that's great. And I just move on because I was very busy. And then after everything happened and the bill got through the Senate and was sitting at the White House, I realized I had this pile of notes and a journal and all these newspaper articles and online articles and videos and all these things that had accumulated over the course of, you know, the previous year of dealing with this situation. And I realized I could write a book about this. I mean, hopefully I can figure out how to write a book. So naively, I decided to launch into writing this book, which, you know, was a much bigger project than I envisioned. But it was good that I didn't really know what I was doing at first, because I don't know if I would have done it. But I'm glad that I did it and it's done and people are finding value in it and learning something. But that's how it came about, really. People just kept suggesting, you know, this would be a good book. You should write a book.
What's the reception been? I mean, I've seen you on social media. I've seen some of the stuff you've done, and it seems like it's been a very warm reception for the book, as you just mentioned earlier. But you know, you've been speaking a lot about the book. You've been doing a lot of signings. How has that whole process been for you? Now that's you've sort of been thrust into the spotlight as a public figure because you're sort of the spearhead of this project and of kind of what you accomplished. So what's that been like for you?
Yes. So I used a lot of the contacts and people that I had known previously from working to get this legislation passed and working with the media campaign and all that to do the book launch. So Women in Aviation International was very supportive and they partnered with me to do the launch at the Women in Military Service for America Memorial here in Arlington back in the beginning of March this year. And it was great. We had, I mean, more than, 130 people or something came to the book launch, which was great. And, wow. You know, news people. And when you do something artistic, like write a book, it's a little bit nerve wracking because you want people to like it, but I mean, that's not necessarily why you're writing it, but you don't want to write something that people think is terrible because they're not going to find value in it. So
right.
I'm very glad that people are enjoying the book. They have really liked it. I have gotten very different reception and different aspects of the book and things I haven't really expected about the book. There's kind of three stories in the book. There's the story of getting this law passed to get my grandmother buried at Arlington. There's the story of my relationship with my grandmother. And then there is a story of kind of her history and the WASP history. So yeah, it's kind of three things all together. So there's a lot going on. There's a little bit of history, a little bit of legislation, how do bills get made? Because I explain the whole process in Congress, like what's going on, what am I doing, why am I going to these different people, why am I focusing on one person versus another person? And people have really responded to that. So I have a lot of young people. I speak at schools. They're really interested in learning about, you know, how do you do activism? How do you get laws passed? How do you make change? And kids are really interested in that. I have other kids who are really into history, who are interested in learning about the WASP and their role during World War II. I have aviation people who are interested in the WASP as aviation figures. And then I've had quite a few people who are very responsive to my discussion of my relationship with my grandmother in the last few years of her life. I used to drive her down to the VA Medical Center in DC to get cancer treatment and to do other appointments. So I spent a lot of time in the car with her driving around and having conversations. So I talk a little bit about that, but
yeah,
it was very hard the last couple years of her life, you know, as she deteriorated in her health. And a lot of people have responded to that. You know, there are a lot of people, I guess, like the baby boomer generation, their parents are, you know, getting older, passing away, and they themselves are getting cancer. I've had people tell me they are really responding to talking about cancer treatment and healthcare and having to take care of an ailing parent or an ailing relative. And those are things I didn't necessarily think about when I was writing. I was just trying to tell the context of the story, but they're really responsive to a lot of those things. One of my law school professors said he was really impressed with my relationship with my grandmother, and he hopes his grandkids kind of have that type of relationship with him and think of him that way when they're older. And so that was really moving. But yeah, I've had a lot of different responses that were unexpected, but people have generally been very positive, and I'm very grateful that people are, like I said, finding value in reading it, learning something from it. It's in lots of libraries, which I'm really honored for.
Yeah.
My mom has a house out in Delaware, and she goes to the library where the book is, and she likes to go and check to see if it's checked out, and she'll text me and say the book is checked out, and she gets very excited. So
that's great.
I get very excited that it's in libraries and schools. A young girl contacted me, I don't know, about a month or two ago. She's doing a project on the WASP. She's in high school. She wanted to ask me some questions, so she emailed me a series of questions that I wrote back. And I said, you know, I wrote a book you can read. And she said, oh, I already checked it out from my library. So I was, I didn't even know it was in, she's up in New York State. I didn't even know it was in her library. So that was really exciting.
That must be the funnest part of kind of doing what you do. Cause now you're educating people. So you're talking about something that a lot of people didn't really realize happened, or maybe just didn't have a clear knowledge about. And I mean, I've been sort of in the same position with what we've done with Earhart. My favorite in emails in the world to get are people, you know, young kids are doing History Day projects and they just want to interview mm-hmm. me for a History Day project. That's like the greatest feeling ever, because they're choosing you to take part in something that they're doing for themselves, to educate themselves. And I that's like one of the biggest honors I think you could ever have. And I think it's fantastic that you're doing that. And I'm not surprised that they're reaching out to you on it. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, so I've been very busy this year. I haven't even written down everything I've done because I was so busy doing it. I didn't have time to like process it all. I've been to air shows. I've been to Texas, California, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin. I've been all over this country, schools, air shows, museums. I've been invited to speak at the Eisenhower Presidential Library this summer. So I'm really excited. And one of, you know, there's all these kind of intimate, moving moments that I think about. One of the really nice ones this past year, I was invited the week after my book launched, was the Women in Aviation and Space Day at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum at Udvar-Hazy out near Dulles Airport. And they had, I think he said 15,000 girls or something came out to that event. And I sat at a table selling my book and signing books for people. And it was the same table that my grandmother had sat at the last time that she was able to sign books, 5 years before that, before she passed away. So that was really a moving day. And my grandmother spent decades going and giving lectures and talks. So I'm really honored to be able to carry on her tradition.
Wow. You've been very, very busy. What is on tap for the next year? What do you have on tap for the next year?
I will probably be traveling a little bit less But as I mentioned, I have been invited to, I've been invited again to the Women in Aviation and Space Day out at Uberhazy in March, the Eisenhower Presidential Library in June, possibly Oshkosh, possibly the Women in Aviation International Conference in Orlando in March, a couple other things. But this is separate from what I do with the book, but I work at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I've been selected as a fellow for Congress this coming year. So I will be working in the United States Senate this year. So I'll probably not have as much time to travel and do things, but I will do my best.
Wow. Well, when you come out in June, if you come out in June, that's in Abilene, Kansas. That's right down the street from where I'm at. So we're going to have to get together. I'd love to come out and see you when you do come out to the Eisenhower.
Yes, they said they're going to, you know, put it on the social media soon. So when they put it up, I'll share it, and you can, I will be honored to have you there.
Absolutely. I would be honored to meet you in person. And this has been a great time. The last question I have for you, Aaron, before we kind of wrap up is, what do you think, and you might've been asked this, you might not have been asked this before, but what do you think your grandmother would think of everything you've done, you know, now, looking back on everything you've done, what do you think she would think of all of it?
I think she would be very proud, and people tell me that all the time, and it's very moving, you know, to hear that. Your grandma would be so proud of you. Not just for what I've done, but to help spread the word about the Women Air Force Service Pilots and teach people about it. That was really her great passion, was helping people learn about it, especially young people learning about World War II and why it was important. And I think the lessons of World War II are increasingly important in our daily lives. And we can learn a lot from that time period and the people that served and came out of that, and not just the WASP, but veterans of all types that served at that time, and civilians. The other thing I say is, I think she would probably think the entire thing was completely ridiculous, and she would be completely flabbergasted that any of this even had to happen at all, because, you know, but at the same time, probably not surprised, because she always, you know, thought she had to go to the government again in 1981 and testify again about her benefits. So I know this was an ongoing thing for her, so I think she wouldn't be surprised, but at the same time, she would just be very flabbergasted that we had to go through all of that just to bury her. And I don't know if she would even have supported that. She probably would have been like, oh, I don't know. Should we just go somewhere else? I don't know. But yeah. I was like, no, we're not giving up. We have to do it. And ironically, you know, going around to schools and things is great, but you only reach, you know, 100 kids, a dozen kids, however many people happen to be at your event. But ironically, because of this whole process and leading this campaign and getting this law passed and working with now Senator McSally and all the other people and all the attention it got, I mean, it was on news programs with 10 million viewers, 15 million viewers. It was on the BBC. You know, people from South Africa were writing me, in Europe and Japan, you know. So it really helped a lot of people learn that these women served during World War II, because we got in a fight with a cemetery. So it's kind of, you know, it accomplished something even greater, you know, than just getting my grandmother the funeral that she deserved to have.
I think it would, I think a lot of people would say it accomplished what it was meant to accomplish. And I think right. That's pretty amazing. So this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on. Where can everybody get the book? Can you plug the book? Do you have a website? Plug it all, please.
I have a website. It is finalflightfinalfight.com, which has pictures of the funeral. It has the funeral video. It has links to news stories and pictures and all kinds of things. It has links to the book. But apart from that, you can buy it on Amazon.com. You can buy it on BarnesandNoble.com, IndieBound, if you're not into corporate things. You can request it from your local bookstore, tell them to buy it and send it to you. And you can tell them to put it on your shelf. Like I said, it's in lots of libraries. If you ask your local library to purchase it, they probably will. I don't know. Most of them have been buying it, which is nice. So yeah, there's lots of outlets, you know, just ask and they should be able to find it and get it for you.
Absolutely. And we'll have links to all that in the show notes and everything we sort of touched on tonight in the show notes for tonight's episode. Aaron, it's been an absolute pleasure. The book is Final Flight, Final Fight. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air, news, show information, and much more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle MeMyFriendsPod. And on Instagram, you can find us by searching the handle @MeAndMyFriendsPod. If you enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes to rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is truly appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. Tonight, the podcast featured the original song Disappear by producer Redeman. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.